Okay, so shift the voice from Ajahn Amaro to myself, and I will go back to the chapters that I wrote. So I'll begin on chapter 15, which is the third chapter of the Practices and Perspectives. And this is on the path and the goal. The first two chapters were on kind of the nature of the path and the kind of both the sense of the gradual path, a sudden path, a middle, and then a middle path, and just the and then the aspects of the need for a complete letting go and relinquishment. So then they come into the third chapter, and in reality, I'm sort of just thinking now. I can't remember what it's about. when it starts here, path and goal, so we'll see where that goes. How then does the path of practice yield an experience of the goal? This question requires careful consideration, for there are many misconceptions of this relationship that can get in the way of actually reaching the goal, even after genuine progress on the path. In the Milindapanha, the monk Nagasena replies to this question with an analogy. The path of practice doesn't cause Nibbana, it simply takes you there. In the same way that the road to a mountain does not cause the mountain to come into being, but simply leads you to where it already is. Question remains, however, to what extent is the goal radically different from the path? To what extent is it similar? And how much of the path carries over into the life of the arahant after the attainment of Nibbana? Or, expressed in terms of Nagasena's analogy, to what extent does one abandon the road to set foot on the mountain, and to what extent do the muscles developed by following the road continue to serve one in good stead while wandering the mountainside? To begin with, we must remember that the path is not identical with the goal. The practice sometimes requires elements that need to be abandoned when the goal is reached. And this is a sutta from a well-known sutta, a sutta that Ananda gives. And it's from the Sanyutta 51, sutta number 15, and is the it's from the Iddipada Sanyutta, so the collection on the Iddipadas. Iddipadas being Chanda Virya Jitta Vimamsa, Chanda being desire or motivation, interest, Chanda Virya, effort, Jitta, sort of application of mind, and Vimamsa, a investigation or reviewing. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Venerable Ananda was dwelling at Kosambi in Kosita's park. Then the Brahmin Unaba approached the Venerable Ananda and exchanged greetings with him. When they had concluded their greetings and cordial talk, he sat down to one side and said to the Venerable Ananda, "For what purpose, Master Ananda, is the holy life lived under the ascetic Gotama?" "It is for the sake of abandoning desire, Brahman, that the holy life is lived under the Blessed One." "But, Master Ananda, is there a path, is there a way for the abandoning of this desire. There is a path, Brahman. There is a way for the abandoning of this desire. But Master Ananda, what is the path, what is the way for the abandoning of this desire? Here, Brahman, a bhikkhu, develops the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to desire and volitional formations of striving. He develops the basis for spiritual power that possesses concentration due to energy, concentration due to mind, concentration due to investigation, and volitional formations of striving. This Brahman is the path, this is the way for the abandoning of this desire. Such being the case, Master Ananda, the situation is interminable. There's no end to it. Not terminable. It is impossible that one can abandon desire by means of desire itself. Well then, Brahman, I will question you about this matter. Answer as you see fit. What do you think, Brahman? Did you earlier have the desire, I will go to the park? And after you went to the park, did the corresponding desire subside? Yes, sir. Did you earlier arouse energy thinking, I will go to the park? And after you went to the park, did the corresponding energy subside? Yes, sir. Did you earlier make up your mind, I will go to the park? And after you went to the park, did the corresponding resolution subside? Yes, sir. Did you earlier make an investigation, shall I go to the park? And after you went to the park, did the corresponding investigation subside? Yes, sir. It is exactly the same, Brahman, with a bhikkhu who is an arahant, one whose taints are destroyed, who has lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, reached his own goal, utterly destroyed the fetters of existence, and is completely liberated through final knowledge. He earlier had the desire for the attainment of arahantship, and when he attained arahantship, the corresponding desire subsided. He earlier had aroused energy for the attainment of arahantship, and when he attained arahantship, the corresponding energy subsided. He earlier had made up his mind to attain arahantship, and when he attained arahantship, the corresponding resolution subsided. He earlier made an investigation for the attainment of arahantship, and when he attained arahantship, the corresponding investigation subsided. What do you think, Brahman? Such being the case, is the situation terminable or interminable? Surely, Master Ananda, such being the case, the situation is terminable, not interminable. That is, it does have an end, indeed. Magnificent, Master Ananda, magnificent. From today forward, let Master Ananda remember me as a late follower who has gone for refuge for life. So I think it's a really important point to recognize that you don't reach understanding and realization through doing nothing and somehow magically achieving realization. And one of the characteristics of the Buddha's teaching that he described it as a wirya-wada. It is a teaching that requires energy or effort. And of course, the effort does need to be right effort. And obviously if one is consumed by desire, consumed by craving, consumed by ambition, and similar to Ajahn Amaro's reflection this morning, consumed by me getting there, that'll reap the same result as doing nothing. so, So it there's it really requires this reflection and investigation of, what is it that actually works to help the mind be free from its entanglements? What is it that helps the mind to relinquish the attachments and clinging that we do have? And that's exactly why the Buddha's teaching is grounded in the Four Noble Truths, so that there is a experiential measuring stick for what works. Because we our logic and our rational mind can come up with any number of logical things that we could be doing or should be doing, and not very trustworthy. You want to come back to experience. What is it that frees the mind from dukkha? General comments?
There's that example in Lumpur Cha's teachings about coconuts.
Ah, yes,
I will often,
right.
that's one of my favorite passages, because it's talking about, in a way, that the English word desire being used in different modes, and Lumpur Cha uses this the simile of going to buy coconuts as a way of talking about using desire to come to the end of desire. So he said, well, if you go to the market and you buy a coconut, then somebody says to you, "So are you going to eat the shells as well as the meat of the coconut there?" And they, "Well, no, of course not." "Well, why did you buy the shells then?" And well, because that's what is the form of the coconut. So he uses that in a skillful way to say that exact kind of use of intentionality and giving direction, making effort with a specific goal in mind, that's appropriate, just like the shell of the coconut. It's part of the package, and that. But when you've actually eaten the flesh of the coconut, then you can throw the shells away or use them for something else. Use them, turn them into a water dipper or something. But it's just because you're not going to eat them doesn't mean to say that it was wasteful. So.
May I ask about this point that not our ideas, but actually the experience of dukkha is a measuring stick for kind of rightness of action and what's supposed to be done. Would it be the case that when you contemplate some situation, that as long as there is still some tension or some pain present, it means that you didn't come to the right understanding of it, the right idea, but once you understood really the situation and all of it, it kind of drops. There would be no unpleasant kind of painful feelings about it.
Yes, and you still have to keep investigating. I mean, in general, it's a really good measure. I mean, it is a really good measuring stick, and quite tr very trustworthy. Because that sense of the kind of tension in the mind, or of a kind of conflict in the heart, is sort of like, okay, something's not quite resolved yet. But then, even when we do, because sometimes, I mean, that's why the Buddha points to the things that are still can still be obstacles, can even be things that are desirable and pleasant. The upaki vipassana upakilesas, the kind of defilements of insight, are incredibly desirable. And so, radiance, mindfulness, energy. All of the good things that we're trying to do. So that still needs to be investigated to see, is there any residual Because there can be maybe a grief at seeing it changing, or a kind of a desperation to hold on to it because it is so good, a fear of losing it. But in general, yes, the that sense of paying attention to the that feeling of tension or a conflict or a lack of clarity is a trustworthy guide.
I would say that also that there's a difference between pain and suffering. So just like you can have a physical pain, like the teaching of the arrow, so that there can be physical pain and it's still painful. There's still the dukkha of that painful feeling, but the mind can hold it in such a way that it's absolutely not a problem. So it's still painful. So there can still be like a difficult situation, like, you know, cold weather and you're not wearing a jacket, like it's freezing. So it's uncomfortable. And there can be that the mind open and equanimous with that, but it's still uncomfortable. And so the Sala Sutta, the arrow, only talks about physical pain, but I would say it does also translate into emotional pain as well. And so that there can be an uncomfortable situation, like someone has died and you're feeling grief. It's a painful emotion, but the mind doesn't have to create suffering around that painful emotion. So that it's one of those areas where it's the English word suffering, kind of, it's not really specific enough, but I would say it's kind of important.
Yeah, it's a very important point, and that also, and just looking back at the Buddha's life and examples from his life where the Buddha experiencing, because there's several suttas and occasions where the Buddha is teaching to the assembly, and then finally he says, my back hurts and I need to have a rest, and Ananda or Sariputta, you know, would you the assembly is still alert and attentive, continue teaching. So he'll go off and lay down, have a bit of a break, and because his back is killing him, so that he wasn't just being a wuss. This is, it was just sort of, this a reality that one can needs to deal with on the physical level and give oneself a break from it. And there's also, and then even that emotional pain, there's a very beautiful, or to me, a very touching sutta where it's after the death of Sariputta and Moggallana, and the Buddha is looking out to the assembly, and he says, you know, the assembly feels empty to me now that Sariputta and Moggallana are no longer with us, but then he goes on and gives a kind of a rousing talk on accepting the reality of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self, and the inevitability of aging at death. It's everybody's inheritance. But he didn't. It wasn't that he didn't have any feelings. Continuing on. Although negative qualities must obviously be abandoned on reaching the goal, other more positive qualities, such as right view, must be abandoned as well, as we noted in the preceding chapter. Even the most exalted states of meditative emptiness, which may contain a lurking sense of self-identification, have to be abandoned in order to reach the goal of total freedom. And There's a quote from Majjhima 106, which is the Anenja Sapaya Sutta, the way to the imperturbable. And again, imperturbable means sort of like unshakable or unmoving, solid, stable. When this was said, the Venerable Ananda said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, here a bhikkhu is practicing thus. It might not be, and it might not be mine. It will not be, and it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning." Thus he obtains equanimity. "Venerable Sir, does such a bhikkhu attain nibbana?" And that phrase, I mean, I tried to look it up in several places and I wasn't that successful. But from my memory, this, "it might not be, and it might not be mine, it will not be, and it will not be mine," is like a popular phrase that was used amongst the circle of samanas, both in terms of in the Buddha's realm, as well as amongst other samanas as well, as a means of stirring relinquishment, letting go, renunciation, and equanimity, and so then, you know, the question is, yeah, okay, then he does attain equanimity with that. Does such a bhikkhu attain nibbana? Do you have any recollection of where?
Yeah. No, I couldn't pin it down.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, it's not.
I usually look up Bhikkhu Bodhi's references.
Yeah, and it was just this weird reference that seemed to reference something else, and then I wasn't able to track it down. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then the reply that the Buddha gives: one bhikkhu here, Ananda, might attain nibbana. Another bhikkhu here might not attain nibbana. What is the cause, what is the reason, Venerable Sir, why one bhikkhu here might attain nibbana, while another bhikkhu here might not attain nibbana? Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu is practicing thus: it might not be, and it might not be mine. It will not be, and it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning. Thus he obtains equanimity. He delights in that equanimity, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. As he does so, his consciousness becomes dependent on it and clings to it. A bhikkhu Ananda who is affected by clinging does not attain nibbana. But, Venerable Sir, when that bhikkhu clings, what does he cling to? To the base of neither perception nor non-perception, Ananda. So, very refined state of the formless attainments. When that bhikkhu clings, Venerable Sir, it seems he clings to the best object of clinging. When that bhikkhu clings, Ananda, he clings to the best object of clinging, for this is the best object of clinging, namely, the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Here, Ananda, a bhikkhu is practicing thus: it might not be, and it might not be mine. It will not be, and it will not be mine. What exists, what has come to be, that I am abandoning. Thus he obtains equanimity. He does not delight in that equanimity, welcome it, or remain holding to it. Since he does not do so, his consciousness does not become dependent on it and does not cling to it. A bhikkhu Ananda who is without clinging attains nibbana. It is wonderful, Venerable Sir, it is marvelous. The Blessed One indeed has explained to us the crossing of the flood in dependence upon one support or another. But, Venerable Sir, what is noble liberation? Here, Ananda, a noble disciple considers thus: sensual pleasures here and now, and sensual pleasures in lives to come. sensual perceptions here and now, and sensual perceptions in lives to come. Material forms here and now, and material forms in lives to come. Perceptions of forms here and now, and perceptions of forms in lives to come. Perceptions of the imperturbable, perceptions of the base of nothingness, and perceptions of the base of neither perception nor non-perception. This is personality as far as personality extends. This, in contrast, is the deathless, namely, the liberation of the mind through not clinging. Thus, Ananda, I have taught the way directed to the imperturbable. I have taught the way directed to the base of nothingness. I have taught the way directed to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. I have taught the crossing of the flood in dependence upon one support or another. I have taught noble liberation. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, Ananda. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, Ananda. Do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. This is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Ananda was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So this sense of the anything where there is a building of identification and a sense of me creating an identity or an attachment to a particular sensual pleasure, sensual perceptions, sensual material forms, material perceptions. Those are sort of the seeking after the pleasurable, seeking after something solid. Perceptions of the imperturbable, the stability of meditative and formless states, base of nothingness, base of neither perceptions. And then this is personality as far as personality extends, because one can create this sense of me, transposing it to even something that is exceedingly refined. And just being able to abide in in non-clinging and in relinquishment, where it's not a negation of experience or a negation of refined states of consciousness or meditative well-being, but establishing a wise relationship with those. With those qualities and with those states. Any comments?
One thing that is curious about the term the imperturbable, an ninja, it seems to be, it's kind of a refined one, but it seems to be used to refer to it's the states of infinite consciousness and infinite space, because they're not sort of mentioned as in the Arupa list there, but it just says the imperturbable.
Right.
So it seems to be like that word is being used to refer to the sphere of infinite space and the sphere of infinite consciousness. I mean, it's a small detail, but also that even then there's those refined territories that the way to liberation is not clinging. It's like the same treatment, sort of same medicine applies in all these different.
It is fantastic that the you just have to be willing to. It's just like Ajahn Chah saying, "There's only two things you need to do: just know and let go." and then that covers the whole path. You know, whether it's on the coarser levels, whether it's on refined levels, it's that again, the relationship one has. But anicca, in that sense of imperturbable or refinement. I mean, because I think also, like in the independent origination cycle, what's pointed to in terms of sankhara is the punyabi sankhara, apunyabi sankhara, anenchabi sankhara, so that these formations that are inclining to the meritorious or the skillful, that's to the unskillful, and then to the, say, unshakable. Yeah.
Would it be a correct interpretation that if something happened before and I remember it, and it means that there is some clinging, so it can be some like life event, or it can be some pleasant state in meditation. But in any way, if it's remembered and like taken as mine, then it would be.
I would say it's a good sign that you remember things. Because mindfulness is like its function. The classical description of mindfulness is that one remembers and calls to mind things that happened even long ago. So that being able to remember of course, we can have an unhealthy relationship, but actually remembering the pleasant or the unpleasant or the skillful or the unskillful things that we do, and using it as a basis for informing one's contemplation or one's actions and relationship. It's like learning from past experience is something that is kind of quite critical, really, rather than trying to trying to disregard or not try to bring to mind at all anything. It's sort of like, what's the result of bringing it to mind? As we can dwell on, and in the same way of even taking a refined mental state, a refined experience, and then identifying with it and creating a sense of attachment to it. And we do that, and that's one of the problems sometimes of quote-unquote successful meditations, is that you remember them, and you really... How do we get back there? That longing for something. So it ends up being an obstacle, even when it's something that. Whereas if we take it and learn from it, then it's a different outcome. Yeah.
The abandonment of factors and sankharas, path factors and sankharas. How much of that is really, how much autonomy is there really in that, and how much of it is really just a ripening and falling away and paying attention to that? Because you can know this is to be let go of, but you just...
There it is again. Yeah, I mean that's why we call it practice, because it really does require a willing and a patience to keep returning to the reality. The patience and real honesty are so crucial to progress on the path and experiencing the fruits of the path.
One of the things in respect to that I'd say is we can't undo past causes. They've already been caused. But what can be done is the way the mind is, where there is agency, there is that sense of autonomy, is the way the mind relates to those causes ripening. So that, you know, so for example, if you had gone into debt, the debt is still there. That cause has been created, so the results of having gone into debt are still going to appear, but how that is met in the present is, you know, up to mindfulness and wisdom. So that I don't want to sound fatalistic, but I feel that is a helpful model to have in mind. So if something keeps coming up over and over, it's not just because you're not working hard to let go, because there is a whole train of causes that have been created around a particular area. Yeah, you've been very conditioned by like your working life or your family life or your personal history, your education, whatever it might be, wholesome, unwholesome, neutral. Then that those causes are going to ripen somehow or other. And so you can't undo those causes. You had that education. You grew up in that in that part of London. You know, you have that family or those events did happen. You can't undo that. But where there's agency or where the sort of transformation can happen is how that's received in this moment. And then the way that things are received then plants fresh causes for skillful effects in the future.
So, just an example, but you know, when the sort of mind feels quite quiet and peaceful, but there's still something that's just kind of niggling away.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, you know, it's not like there's any thoughts, you know, creating a bubble, but there's still some feeling. It's not like a physical thing. It's kind of, Then we call it emotion or whatever. But there's something that doesn't feel quite right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you can't work what it is or how it go, or it's not obvious. I mean, how do you kind of...
How do you work with that? Patience and honesty, in the sense of, you know, rather than trying to kind of cover it over with some rationale or logic from some, said no, there's something still there somehow, and being willing to return to it and not just dismiss it. Because one has, on paper, one's done what one you think you should have done or what the Ajahns have told you to do, sort of thing. But it's really taking the interest and time to sort of... And you can't dwell... Because sometimes you have to wait for something to ripen, like... Again, we're talking about causes. You put causes into place. And, you know, sometimes it takes a long time for it to really ripen. And that's where a certain, say, saddha or trust or faith or confidence is important. And so that maybe paying attention to the building of a reviewing of the things that do arise or bring about the arising of confidence and trust in the process, in the path itself, in the teaching, and then sometimes you just have to be willing to wait for it to ripen, something where, you know, oftentimes changes without even thinking about it. So that sense of patience is I mean, patience is a terrible word in English, because it seems because it's...
Some people even have it as a name.
Yeah.
It's a girl's name.
Yes. Yeah, and but it it uh, it really, because in the English language, it feels like one is just putting up with something until it's, you know, over, and so you're having to, but patience in the from a Buddhist perspective is a barami, and a barami are really bright qualities. So this sense of patience is much more of a willingness to be present with experience and not be, say, not be shaken by that. And so then, it was really frustrating going, you know, being like a disciple of Ajahn Chah and going to him with all your questions and your all your problems and difficulties and waiting for Ajahn Chah to solve them for us and he just tell us to be patient. It was very frustrating. but there is that sense of you have to allow it to be there sometimes, and it doesn't mean you have to dwell on it, but just acknowledge, okay, something's not resolved, and I don't quite know what it is. I can't get my finger on it yet, but it's sort of that sense of just being patient and open with it. Yeah.
I recently put a quote by Ajahn Chah in my email signature line, and it's, patience isn't a strategy, it's an abiding place.
Oh, that's nice. Yes, that's exactly why the Kanti Paramang Thapo Titika, that sense of Kanti, the patience being the supreme sort of thing that resolves defilement. Okay, so not only is attachment to the path abandoned at the moment of awakening, but so is attachment to the goal. And the next quote is it's a short quote, but it's a bit punchy. It's from the first discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, the root of all things. And it is basically going through all of the ways that one lets go and non-attachment anyway. He directly knows Nibbana as Nibbana. Having directly known Nibbana as Nibbana, he should not conceive himself as Nibbana. He should not conceive himself in Nibbana. He should not conceive himself apart from Nibbana. He should not conceive Nibbana to be mine, quote unquote. He should not delight in Nibbana. Why is that? So that he may fully understand it, I say. Right? So that full understanding of all experience and Mula Pariyaya Sutta goes through all the bases of experience and the senses and the elements and the different attainments and the different he directly knows Nibbana as Nibbana. Having directly known Nibbana as Nibbana, he should not conceive himself as Nibbana, should not conceive himself in Nibbana, he should not conceive himself apart from Nibbana, he should not conceive Nibbana to be mine, he should not delight in Nibbana. Why is that? So he may fully understand it, I say. So it's that full understanding that is the key to relinquishment and realization. Any comments?
Well, yeah, that's an extraordinarily comprehensive sutta. It's also notable that at the end is...
Oh, yes.
At the end of that sutta, it casually says, and those bhikkhus did not delight in the Blessed One's words.
Yes.
So it's like, sutta number one in the Majjhima is like, nope.
No.
Don't agree.
I don't like it. Shouldn't be that way. I don't want it like to be like this.
It's extremely detailed, achingly thorough. Yeah. And at the end of it, nope. Yeah. Don't accept that.
Even the appreciation for the Dhamma needs to be relinquished on approaching the final goal. And this next quote is from Anguttara 9, Sutta number 36. And it's called the Jhana Sutta, which throughout the sutta, the Buddha points to the contemplation constituents of the experience of the all the respective jhanas, in particular five khandhas. So the constituents of jhana, the five khandhas themselves, you're relying on the contemplation of anicca, dukkha, anatta. He turns his mind away from those phenomena, and having done so, inclines his mind to the property of deathlessness. This is peace. This is exquisite. The resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. I saw a typo. I don't have a marker. I'll get a pencil at him. Mm-hmm. Staying right there, he reaches the ending of the mental fermentations. Or, if not, through passion and delight for this very property of deathlessness, and from the total wasting away of the first five of the fetters, self-identity views, grasping at precepts and practices, uncertainty, sensual passion, and irritation. He is due to be reborn in the pure abodes, there to be totally unbound, never again to return from that world. So that the what's pointing to is say inclining the mind to deathlessness, the amata dhamma, if one really reflects on that sense of the this is peace, this is exquisite, the resolution of all fabrications, sabbasankara samatha, bringing to tranquility the intentions within the mind, the sankharas, relinquishment of all acquisitions, sambhupadi pati nisaka, the upadi are usually translated as acquisitions, but what we acquire are the five khandhas, and this we acquire form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, and take it on as our identity and have attachment to it. The ending of craving, tanha kayo, and that's the ending, it's a resolution, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. Those are all alluding to the ending of suffering. So staying right there, if one stays at that and is able to clearly recognize that, one reaches the end of the mental formation, one would realize arahantship. Or, if not, through passion and delight for that very property of deathlessness, so that the word that's used, the dhamma ragena, the dhamma nandiya, so that desire for the dhamma, that delight in the dhamma, so that one gets really excited about that truth, Then one ends up in anagami, which is, it's not so bad, but the full liberation is certainly the goal, and just recognizing that even that delight in the Dhamma that can hinder the penetration of the truth. So that but it goes through all as a sutta, it does go through all of the different. There's enough time to read the whole thing, because it does go through the. I think it's also interesting, and it does. The destruction of the taints occurs in dependence on all of the different bases of concentration, because I say that the destruction of the taints occurs in dependence on the first jhana. I say that the destruction of the taints also occurs in dependence on the second jhana. I say that the destruction of the taints also occurs in dependence on the third jhana. I say that the destruction of the taints also occurs in dependence on the fourth jhana. So that all of these, it's not that there's just one quality of mind or one state of mind that is reserved for penetrative insight, but all of the refinements and states of stability can be the foundation if one turns one's attentions appropriately. I say that the destruction of the taints also occurs in dependence on the base of the infinity of space. I say that the destruction of the taints also occurs in dependence on the base of the infinity of consciousness. These are the formless attainments. I say that the destruction of the taints also occurs in dependence on the base of nothingness. I say that the destruction of taste also occurs in dependence on the base of neither perception nor non-perception. I say that the destruction of taste also occurs in dependence on the cessation of perception and feeling. So that from the beginnings of the settling of the mind to the most refined states, all of them can be a basis for realization. When it was said, because I say that the destruction of the taints occurs in dependence on the first jhana, for what reason was this said? Here, secluded from sensual pleasures, one goes through the stock phrases, a bhikkhu enters and dwells in the first jhana. He considers whatever phenomena exist there pertaining to form, feeling, perception, volitional activities, and consciousness, considers them as impermanent, suffering, an illness, a boil, a dart, misery, affliction, alien, disintegrating, empty, and non-self. So all the different permutations of anicca, dukkha, anatta. He turns his mind away from those phenomena and directs it to the deathless element thus. This is peaceful, this is sublime, so forth. And then, so that if he is firm in this, he attains the destruction of the taints. If he does not attain the destruction of the taints, because of that lust for the Dhamma, because of that delight in the Dhamma, then with the utter destruction of the five lower fetters, it becomes one spontaneous birth, due to attain final Nibbana there, without ever returning from that world. Just as an archer or archer's apprentice undergoes training on a straw man or a heap of clay, and then at a later time becomes a long-distance shooter, a sharpshooter, one who splits a great body, so too, secluded from sensual pleasures, and going through the jhanas, he considers, and the contemplation of the impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self of the five khandhas. So when it was said, because I say the destruction of the taints also occurs in dependence on the fourth jhana, it is because of this that this was said. And then it goes through the, I say the destruction of the taints also occurs in dependence on the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. I say the destruction of taints occurs in dependence on the base of infinity of space. And then it changes because it doesn't use the contemplation of form in that, because these are formless attainments, so that the mind has basically dropped the perception of body and is dwelling in the mind, in the realm of the mind. So then infinity of space, infinity of consciousness, and then the base of nothingness, those are all contemplated with the impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self of feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. And it is interesting because there's lots of commentarial literature saying that, you know, these you can't contemplate, you're not thinking, but there's obvious reflection and attending to this as an experience. But then the base of neither perception or non-perception or the is too subtle for contemplation. That's just not mentioned. And then the cessation of perception of feeling is described as a base that. These two bases, as a source of, there's penetration to final knowledge as far as meditative attainments accompanied by perception reach. But these two bases, the base of neither perception nor perception, the cessation of perception and feeling, I say, are to be described by meditative bhikkhus skilled in attainments and skilled in emerging from attainments after they have attained them and emerge from them, so that those are not a base of contemplation or reflection. They're kind of reflected on after the fact.
And that is a very similar description in one of the suttas in the Majjhima makes exactly that same point. Yeah. So even if the reflection isn't conceptual, that there's that capacity to contemplate and to...
Yeah.
To consider in those up to the realm of nothingness, yeah. But beyond that, it's so sort of refined, so acute, so focused that there's not even that kind of wordless contemplation is possible.
Not even wordless contemplation goes there. 7:01. Enough for this evening.